This feature of the Science News Radio Network is coming to you from our studios in Dallas, Texas. Science News is on the air right now.
This is the promise of tomorrow, where people and industry keep up with the business of emerging and nanotechnologies. The fields covered in this series of programs will include energy, defense, aerospace, medicine, semiconductors, and more. For the next hour, Colonel Mason will introduce his experts, and you'll be on the cutting edge of the promise of tomorrow.
Yes, so good to be with you again. In just a minute, I want to introduce you to Misha Shattuck. She's with MIT's Lincoln Laboratory as a senior humanitarian advisor, and we'll be talking about her track of humanitarian at the Homeland Security Technology Conference going on in Boston in late October. More on that at our website, promiseoftomorrow.biz. The right-hand side of your screen, you'll see a link. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to the Science News Radio Network special presentation, Promise of Tomorrow with Colonel Mason. Those of you listening on radio can also hear us commercial-free online anytime, webcast, at promiseoftomorrow.biz. At this time, I want to introduce you to Misha Shattuck with the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in Lincoln Laboratories. She's senior humanitarian advisor for them. She's also the chairman of the Humanitarian Assistance and Disaster Relief Track for IEEE at the Homeland Security Technology Symposium going on this year in Boston, Massachusetts, in late October. So, Misha, so welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, you're chairman of the Humanitarian Track, which is new this year for Homeland Security Technology, and I'd like to explain to us a little bit about what you have planned for that particular track.
Well, we are delighted to bring about the humanitarian track this year. When you look back at the core purpose of IEEE in their mission statement, they talk about the ability to foster technological innovation and excellence to benefit humanity and to really bring technology and technology professionals into the room of improving global conditions. And so with that, having the track this year is going to be an opportunity to bring together technologists, scientists, and engineers to think and to take advantage of the work that's being done where we can really use technology to transform people's lives, both in terms of kind of this overall humanitarian context and in issues around development, as well as issues around bringing technology into disaster relief and disaster response operations.
Well, I see you're an expert in the technology landscape in the humanitarian sector, and you've been actively working to connect technologists to affected populations and professional humanitarians, and it is a whole new concept for my brain to get around, and actually we think of food and we think of medical assistance in disaster areas, but the technology is incredibly important.
And so technology that can do things, for example, MIT Lincoln Laboratory partnered with an organization that was funded by the Roddenberry Foundation, which I think Lincoln Laboratory, all of our Star Trek fans were thrilled to be able to work with them as Gene Roddenberry started Star Trek. But we did a water and power system, because when you don't have power, oftentimes water systems themselves are compromised. So that is one example of a technology. Then you can swing all the way to the other pendulum of technology where we're using systems like LIDAR technology. We see right now with the humanitarian crisis happening in terms of the epic migration crisis and how important it is for migrants who are fleeing war-torn countries and regions to be able to have communication, to be able to set up things like mesh networks and to have access to the internet to help them as they really are kind of fleeing. And many of these situations can be life or death. And so the technologies that we see in this space can be anything from simple apps onto phones as well as to really powerful internet connectivity. So we're seeing a lot of balloons and what we can do with Wi-Fi in those situations. So it's a pretty broad and dynamic space.
Well, these innovative technological solutions have been used now in more recent years in remote areas in Africa. We've had some numerous guests on this program telling us about ways of generating electricity through through weights and lifts and bicycle type devices and other things like that into the backcountry and using cameras on cell phones to send photographs of illnesses and things back to Cape Town and other places to try to diagnose whatever diseases happen to be, you know, from back in the bush. I would think that a lot of these things are currently in place. Have you had any personal work with people like this that can give those assistance and relief?
Certainly. And so I, throughout my career, have had the opportunity to work with numerous non-governmental organizations and intergovernmental organizations such as the UN. And it is, as you're speaking to, this need to connect the appropriate technology to the appropriate affected communities. One of the things that we're hoping to do within the conference is to not only bring together these technologists and scientists, but to be able to have some really honest discussions about when is it appropriate to bring technology. I think as scientists and technologists, we often believe that technology can solve any problem, but we do need to take a moment, pause, reflect on what technology is needed where and how that technology can and should be adopted by the affected populations. And so, just as you're saying, you know, why is it sometimes we can get amazing technology somewhere that seems so incredibly far? So whether that's the African continent or, you know, a small island in the Philippine archipelago, you know. And I would also like to highlight that the role that the United States military has played, certainly the National Guard, has done a tremendous effort and continues to be working, the Army Corps of Engineers. So I think that the United States government has had an all-hands-on-deck approach to this response.
Well, of course, we're warned by climatologists that Maria and Katrina and some of the other devastating storms we've had in more recent years is only the beginning, and that we're going to be looking for a whole lot more of these massive disaster areas. Are we going to be prepared for that? Do you see us gearing up?
I do, and I think that this is one of the reasons why for this year's IEEE conference that we want to start having highlighting technologies as well as having discussions of what might be coming down the road, just as you're saying, increased frequency in the number of storms as well as the intensity of storms. We as the technology community need to start preparing now and to building capacities as we anticipate this big change that might be coming our way.
The other question that that we have is that you're associated with Massachusetts Institute of Technology and the Lincoln Laboratories. How do they, a woman who's worked so hard with the UN and with other humanitarian efforts, get attached to Lincoln Laboratories?
I was very fortunate in that I was, I think like many people, in 2010 when Haiti experienced their earthquake, so many of us wanted to do something to help. And at the time, I was working at the Harvard School of Public Health, and I put some feelers out asking, hey, does anybody know of a group who might need somebody with a public health background? And it turns out that Harvard and MIT were responding to the earthquake. And I went to MIT and I listened to Dr. Mark Sisman, who is an associate director, he's the associate division head here at Lincoln Laboratory of the cybersecurity division. But Mark had gone down at the request of United States Southern Command And when he was there, he partnered up with Dr. Louise Ivers, who is a physician and infectious disease specialist at Mass General Hospital, but she at the time was also one of the medical directors of an organization that many humanitarians are familiar with, an organization called Partners in Health. And Dr. Ivers was living in Haiti. She'd been there about 8 years. She was there at the time of the earthquake. And Mark and Louise partnered up, and they were supported by and working alongside the United States military. And after hearing Mark speak at MIT, I met with him afterwards, and cut to an hour later, where I was speaking with my husband, saying, do you remember me offering, thinking about how I could help in Haiti? Do you still think that's a good idea? And he said, yes. This happened to be on a Friday. And I said, well, good, because I'm leaving on Monday to go to Haiti, and I'm going to be there for about 6 weeks. And that was my first opportunity to work with Lincoln Laboratory. And while I had certainly was very familiar with the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, I wasn't familiar with Lincoln, which happens to be MIT's largest lab and the part of MIT that works in partnership with the U.S. government as a federally funded research and development center. And so I went down to Haiti as a Harvard person, and I ended up coming back and coming to work for Lincoln Laboratory as the lab was starting to really think about how we as a group of technologists who are focused on issues around national security. When I started at the lab, I was working much more with my public health hat on, but over the past 8 years, have really transitioned to this wider humanitarian sector and leveraging technology in the humanitarian space.
Well, it's a fascinating story, and quite good that you had the support of your husband when you told him you were going to go to Haiti, of all places, because Haiti has quite a reputation for of all the disaster with the crime and everything else that goes on there. So as chairman of the Humanitarian Assistance and Disaster Relief for the IEEE Homeland Security Technology Symposium going on in late October, you have arranged a couple of, I hear, some pretty high-powered plenary speakers, Pablo Suarez and Aaron Coughlin de Perez. Can you give us some sort of a sketch on what to expect from them?
Absolutely. So Dr. Suarez is the Associate Director for Research and Innovation at the Red Cross and Red Crescent Climate Center. Mm-hmm. I had the opportunity to meet Dr. Suarez several years ago when we were introduced by Dr. Jordan Krauser from Smith University. And at the time, Pablo was thinking about how are ways that we can get people to think and to respond to really big problems using serious games. And it was one of those meetings with somebody who is incredibly smart and driven. He has a CV that it could just go on for pages and be incredibly humbling, but he was so friendly and outgoing, and the way that he was approaching this problem, it just made everybody in the room interested. And being that he has the opportunity to help lead, you know, how the Red Cross and Red Crescent, how their climate center are thinking about ways that we as a global community are going to respond to climate change, I think that Pablo will bring a very dynamic and inspirational, just a great talk. And he's going to do it in partnership with his colleague, who's the manager of the climate science team, who also happens to be a research scientist at Columbia University, Dr. Aaron Coughlin de Perez. These two are thinking about really innovative ways of doing. One thing they're working on are forecast-based financing systems. They're running pilots in more than 10 countries around the world and looking at new ways to integrate funding mechanisms with early action protocol to prevent and prepare for the impacts of extreme events. And these two understand when you are looking at bringing in a new way to do not just disaster response, but preparation, and how do you prepare for things like this, I know that they're just hungry to hear the ideas from the technology community. And so I think it'll be a really interesting talk. And I also think more than most kind of keynote speakers, I think that this will end up being a two-way conversation. So I think it'll be a lot of fun for those in the audience.
We're really looking forward to it, and I will really appreciate an opportunity to interview both Paulo Suarez and Aaron Coghlan de Perez on this program, if there's a way that that you can arrange it. And I hear that you mentioned, for my own curiosity, I hear you mention the Red Cross and the Red Crescent in the same breath, and that leads me to a burning question that I've had for a long time. Are they able to put politics and religion aside and work together without personalities and without trying to one-up the other?
Absolutely. So as humanitarians, part of... To be a humanitarian actually has a very specific definition. Mm-hmm. And I think it's one of those terms that can be thrown around easily where people think, oh, that individual or their organization, they're doing a really kind, good thing for the world, so what a nice humanitarian thing. But when you look at an organization like the Red Cross and Red Crescent organization, they have to adhere to neutrality, and they have to adhere to helping individuals. And so for the Red Cross and Red Crescent societies, they don't look at politics. They don't look at religion. They focus on the needs of affected populations.
Okay. Well, Misha, this is just fascinating stuff. We're so looking forward to it. And I guess I would like to know, what have we missed? What haven't I brought up? What is it that you would like to have the takeaway? What do you want the audience to, the one big point you want your people to drive home when your speakers present at the Humanitarian Technology Assistance and Disaster Relief track of the IEEE Homeland Security Conference?
I think that I'm really looking forward to our participants who come to this conference coming certainly to present the technologies and the ideas that they've been working on, but also coming with an open mind to understand more about the challenges that the global community are facing and to get excited about working on these problems and coming up with some innovative ways for how they can potentially bring technology to meet some of these challenges that we as a global community are facing.
All right. Sounds great. And, Misha, before we go, I know that you've, in your wonderful career, you've been mentored many times by people that you admire and respect, and now you're in the position as a senior humanitarian advisor for MIT and Lincoln Labs. You're doing tons of mentoring yourself. How about a word to live by? How about a creed, an idea, or a thing that guides you through your career and through your life and in your dealings with people? Do you have something that you can give us that's nice and succinct and quotable?
Nice, succinct, and quotable. One of the things as a mentor, I mentor a lot of young women who work in STEM. And my most recent thing that I have been saying, we often hear the fake it till you make it. And I always like to take that one step farther where I say fake it till you make it, but don't make it up. So it's important to approach problems with confidence and to trust all of the skills that we have. But when it comes to issues around the humanitarian world, it is important that we really stick to the facts of science and that we really stick to the intrinsic definition of what it means to be a humanitarian, and that really is focusing on the needs of the population. And so we try to kind of balance what we think we can do, what we want to do, with what is actually needed.
All right. Great stuff, Misha. Misha Shattuck, the chairman of the Humanitarian Assistance and Disaster Relief Track for IEEE at the Homeland Security Technology Symposium going on late October. If you want to know more about that symposium, you can find a link at our website, promiseoftomorrow.biz. On the right-hand side of your screen will be a link to the website for that symposium, and you can learn all about it then. And we'll look forward, Misha, to hearing your speakers speak and how well organized will be that track. Thank you so much for being a guest on the program today.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to the Science News Radio Network special presentation, Promise of Tomorrow, with Colonel Mason. Those of you listening on radio can also hear us commercial-free online anytime, webcast, at promiseoftomorrow.biz. All right, we have with us on the line a very interesting woman, Dr. Ina Mishra. She's the postdoctoral research associate at the College of Pharmacy at the University of North Texas Health Science Center in Fort Worth. She's going to be speaking at MetroCon, and we're all really looking forward to that. That'll be most interesting. So welcome to the program, Dr. Mishra.
Thank you so much.
Would you tell us what is exactly the... I know that you're doing a lot of research in type 2 diabetes. I understand you're on the verge of maybe some breakthroughs with treating or at least discovering type 2 diabetes, the worldwide epidemic preceded by pre-diabetes, and that's where you're concentrating. Is that correct? Can you give us kind of a preview of what we can expect to hear at the conference?
Yes. So we are basically assessing the metabolic health using compact NMR, and that's what my title is. So we are looking at a very new approach using the NMR relaxometry to assess the metabolic health, and the atypical biomarker which we are using is the water relaxation time that comes out of the NMR. So this is really a very new approach to assess the metabolic health, and our whole purpose of assessing this health is because diabetes doesn't occur by itself. So there are transitional stages that precede it. And, for example, pre-diabetes is a stage that precedes diabetes. It occurs before diabetes, and it's very well known and identified. But there is also a stage of early metabolic dysfunction that occurs before pre-diabetes, and that is when the metabolic dysfunction starts. And that is our focus to identify, because by the time pre-diabetes occurs, a significant loss of beta cell function has already occurred. So it's logical to have an early prevention for an early detection intervention. So that's how we are focusing on this whole metabolic dysfunction and diabetes path.
Yeah, if you can isolate the pre-diabetes, the idea is that it'll be easier to treat and maybe prevent some of the very serious consequences of full-blown diabetes. Is that the point?
That is, but we are focusing mainly on the non-diabetics, which are pre-diabetic, and the people who have normal glucose. So they, according to the current clinical criteria, they would be normal because they have normal glucose. But what we are focusing on is within that stage, while they have normal glucose, that is because of the compensatory hyperinsulinemia. So they have yet not developed pre-diabetes, but they are not metabolically healthy. So when they have the compensatory hyperinsulinemia, the insulin levels increase, which keep the glucose levels normal, but along with it, what happens is a subclinical dysproteinemia. So there are specific proteins in the blood that increase, and the shift in levels of those specific proteins during this stage. So because by the time pre-diabetes occur, we can easily detect it by the current methods.
Okay, Ina, I got to stop you there for a minute. We got a break at the half hour for station ID. We're talking to Ina Mishra. She's the postdoctoral research associate at the College of Pharmacy, University of North Texas Health Science Center in Fort Worth. Very interesting studies. She's about the doing of the early detection of diabetes. And we're going to explain more when we come back in the second half hour here on the Science News Radio Network. So please stick around with us. Okay, as we walk to the break at the half hour, we're going to pause at the door of the Den of Strangers, where we keep locked away all of the wisdom of mankind. Who in the Den of Strangers will we meet today?
Albert Einstein. Out of clutter, find simplicity. From discord, find harmony. In the middle of difficulty lies opportunity.